Shrink Wrap Radio Number 471, An Introduction to Integral Psychotherapy with Dr. Mark Forman.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
Today, my guest is psychologist and author, Dr. Mark Forman, and we'll be discussing his book, A Guide to Integral Psychotherapy, Complexity, Integration, and Spirituality in Practice. For more information about Dr. Mark Forman, please see our show notes on shrinkwrapradio.com. One of today's sponsors is audible.com. who has more than 180,000 audiobooks and spoken audio products. Get a free audiobook of your choice at www.audibletrial.com/shrink. And before we go to the interview, I want to let all you professionals know that our strategic partner, the Jung Platform, has created CE courses from selected Shrink Wrap Radio interviews on topics such as dreams, relationships, synchronicity, trauma, and more. Go to www.jungplatform.com to see the latest courses. Now, here's today's interview. Dr. Mark Forman, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Hi, David. Thank you for having me.
Well, it's good to have this opportunity to speak with you about integral psychotherapy, a topic I knew nothing about until receiving your book, which is titled A Guide to Integral Psychotherapy, Complexity, Integration, and Spirituality in Practice. A very interesting title, and very provocative. It did seem complex as I got into it, but then I suppose a lot of psychotherapies would.
Yes.
Well, before we get into the book itself, I have the impression that integral psychotherapy has its roots in the thinking of Ken Wilber. Do I have that right?
Yes, that is absolutely correct. For those who, you know, may not be familiar with Ken Wilber, he was a writer who came primarily out of the humanistic and probably more specifically the transpersonal movements in the 70s here in the U.S. And his initial writings were really about how to connect the Western psychotherapeutic traditions with the Eastern meditative traditions. And he presented an early model, which was called the spectrum of consciousness, which attempted to link all of these different approaches to growth and change and insight together.
I think I read that back in the day, and it was pretty impressive the way he, as you say, created a model and kind of maps of consciousness that were pretty compelling.
Yes, and he was a young man at that time. He was in his early 20s or mid-20s when he wrote some of his first books. And what they did, and what I and some others have been expanding on, is connect the various forms of growth work together according to the models that Ken has suggested, so that all the
Yeah, you point out that he was a young man, and I have the impression that he was then and maybe still is something of a phenom.
Yes, he's a very precocious mind. I think autodidact probably is a word to use. You know, he was a graduate student in the sciences, really in biochemistry, and briefly, I think, was in medical school. But yes, so the leanings in his writings feel scientific, and I think that really comes from his scientific background. And at a certain point, I think he was exposed to Eastern mystical texts, particularly the Tao Te Ching, and Alan Watts was a big influence. And that then sort of showed him that his real interest was in these more humanistic psychological transpersonal dimensions. And so he essentially spent the time where he might have written his graduate biochemistry thesis to write an early draft of his first book.
How extensive has his involvement in Buddhism been? Because I did watch on YouTube, he's got a number of, I was surprised to discover that there are a lot of YouTube videos, because I think back early on, I had the impression that he was pretty reclusive and he was kind of a mysterious figure, but it looks like he's very much out into the open now. And he actually referred to his guru, I don't remember who it was, but he did credit someone as kind of being a guru, and I thought it might be Tibetan Buddhism, but I'm not sure.
Yes, for a long time he was quite reclusive. I think he had exposure to teachers, but he really spent his time reading and writing and meditating hours a day for, you know, several decades, and was not that out in the public. At a certain point in about the year 2000 or so, that changed, and he started to do interviews and has become somewhat more of a popularizer of his own system rather than someone who's writing, you know, the densely kind of complex work that he used to write. His spiritual tradition, he has done a lot of work in Zen. And he has had a lot of exposure to Tibetan Buddhism. And I would say that those are probably the primary spiritual traditions that he aligns with. Although he meets with people from sort of all spiritual traditions and kind of hosts. He lives in Denver and sort of hosts a moving group that sort of moves through meeting with him in Denver. And he gets a lot of sort of exposure to the world through his loft. He's fairly ill and has been for a long time. Yeah, with a kind of some sort of retroviral disease, not HIV, and that has really essentially given him a form of severe chronic fatigue. And so he's been in some bad shape physically since really the 2000s, and that has also one of the reasons why his production as a writer slowed around the turn of the millennia.
Oh, that's useful background to have.
Yeah.
And I'm realizing I misspoke. He didn't actually refer to his, quotes, guru, but he did. He said, my teacher, and that's what I'm recalling now. Now, how did you become involved with Ken Wilber's work?
Sure. So when I was in my later teens, I had gotten involved with a particular yoga community, and I had started meditating, and I was also involved in a martial arts community, very seriously studying and practicing under a teacher. And at the same time, I was being exposed to science. I was pre-medical in college and reading philosophy. And I think I started to have, you know, some basic questions about, for example, what was the difference between a fundamentalist religious person who might picket outside of the college cafeteria, you know, telling people they're not, they shouldn't go to hell, versus somebody like the Dalai Lama, who also seemed to have, you know, a very sort of spiritual worldview, but it didn't feel the same. There wasn't quite the same emotional response or the same level of judgment involved. And so I started to have a bunch of those questions, and then I didn't really know how to articulate them. And I had heard of Ken Wilber and saw in a bookstore down the street from my college dorm that there was this big, thick book that was new called Sex, Ecology, and Spirituality. And I picked up a little of it and liked what I read, and then sort of proceeded in the next 2 weeks. It's about an 800-page book to work my way through it, and, you know, it was almost sort of a bit of a a spiritual experience in and of itself. I've come to find out that that's actually not that uncommon for people who first pick up Wilbur, that there's a lot of big moments of insight. And he really had, at that point, this was 1995, put out the most mature version of his work to date, which was then called the Integral Model. So the Integral Model in Integral Psychotherapy is really kind of this matured version of Wilbur's work that shows itself in this book in 1995.
And I think there's an Integral Center here in California somewhere.
Yes. So there has been since that time a kind of growing awareness of Ken's work, and there are various centers and groups. Some of them are more discussion-based or more philosophical. Some of them are very focused on bringing in different kinds of spiritual practices or therapeutic practices. But here in California, in Boulder, and as well internationally in Brazil, in Japan, so his work has spread pretty widely since that time.
Yeah. So what does the term integral mean in
yes.
the way that he uses it?
So the mantra of integral, if we had to boil it down to anything, is this idea that everybody is partially right about what they argue is important or what they point out is fundamental and key to people. And so the mantra becomes true but partial, so that when someone offers a perspective, there's always a truth in it, even if that truth seems like it's been distorted, but there's something in there that we need to pay attention to. And that is kind of the grounding principle of how Wilbur did his work, and it's the kind of continuing grounding principle for how those of us who use his work continue to apply it. So that's the major idea. Then there are basically in Integral five basic conceptual elements, which are called quadrants, levels, lines, states, and types.
Yeah, we'll be going through those in some detail.
Yes.
But go ahead.
And those five components, and generally how Wilbur has envisioned those, are the Integral Model as applied to Wilbur. There are other folks who have been using the term integral. So Sri Aurobindo would be one who has integral yoga. And there are others as well. But the integral that I refer to, we refer to, is very specifically based on those five elements.
Okay. And maybe you've already spoken to this, but what about it draws you to the integral movement? What is it that speaks to you and has caused you to kind of move your professional career around these ideas?
Sure, it's a great question. So what the integral model really allows is it allows each of us, and I think each profession, to accept the truths from more traditional kind of worldviews. On one hand, so to incorporate some key aspects of the spiritual worldview that all cultures have held, it allows us to absorb the modern kind of scientific, rational perspective that's pretty powerful right now and in our world. It also allows us to absorb what we might call the postmodern sort of deconstructive, sensitive, philosophical dimension of the culture that's now present, very present in the Bay Area where you and I are located. And then it even suggests things that might happen after that. So what sets Integral apart, at least from some other approaches or ways of looking at, you know, the human person and society, is just that it allows a freedom to accept and to engage and to apply the perspectives from all of these different types of cultures and sort of waves of human knowing, so that we don't have to split ourselves off or simply take one side. We can be integral, we can be inclusive. And the freedom that that allows is a very compelling freedom for, I think, those of us who are looking for it and resonate with that kind of expanded viewpoint.
Yeah, I can really understand the appeal of that. And partially what I'm getting is that you don't have to dumb yourself down at all in terms of other things that you know and you know, that are have either scientifically or in other ways been kind of validated in your experience. And the word integral also suggests to me integration, and it sounds like that's really what he's working at. And I guess Ken Wilber would principally be considered a philosopher, or maybe a spiritual teacher. And as far as I know, he doesn't have any training as a psychotherapist. So how did integral psychotherapy get developed?
Yes. I think your characterization is accurate. He's best thought of as either a philosopher. I've heard the term theoretical psychologist thrown around, which is not a bad one. But essentially what Ken had done through various iterations of his work was map out a sort of meta model of how all these treatment approaches might relate to one another. But as I refer to it, the model was fairly skeletal, meaning that the bones were there and there was a structure. But because Ken is not a psychotherapist, it was hard for people to directly apply in this basic question of, so someone walks into your practice office, what do you do as an integral psychotherapist, or if you are trying to apply Ken's work? So for kind of what you might consider the second generation of folks who are coming in the wake of Wilber writing Integral, that was the question, not only in psychotherapy, but in other fields. Okay, how do you apply this? Everybody seems to feel like it's very applicable. But how to take that skeletal model and those suggestions and actually weave it into the work that we do. And so that became a guiding question in my graduate education, and as I was starting to see clients, and I did a dissertation that really focused as much as I could on that question. Later sort of put it down for a while to practice being a therapist for several more years. And then after that, which would have been, you know, 5 to 7 years of practice total, I wrote a book which was intended to answer just that question. So from the eyeball view of a therapist, how do the elements of integral theory apply, and how do we fill these out with details and suggestions that are meaningful for people?
So is your book the first systematic and comprehensive treatment of integral psychotherapy?
Well, there were, around the time that my book came out, a couple of other treatments of the subject, but they were a little more general in their applications. So there's, you know, a lot of sort of levels of applying integral theory to psychotherapy. So one of them was a little more focused on some psychotherapeutic application. Another was a bit more on assessment, so how to use integral to assess people, and that was by a fellow named Andre Marquise. The application book was by a fellow named Keith Witt. I think mine was the most real, in-depth, how do you apply this sort of what I like to call the eyeball view book, because that was what I most wanted to know. That was really my question. How does this theory inform practice and sort of inform, if you were, the state of practice, meaning that when you are sitting with a client or working with a client, you're going in and out of particular states of consciousness, states of concern, states of curiosity. And so I think I was the one to really take on that project first.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, you know, that was sort of, that's my major interest. Other people have now written about this as applied, integral as applied to psychopharmacology. There's a wonderful new book that's applying this to psychopathology. So looking at all of the categories of diagnoses through an integral lens, which is really a very important book for our field.
Yeah.
And that's by the same fellow, Andre Marquise, and another main writer fellow is Elliot Ingersoll.
I should ask if Ken Wilber has read your book and given it his good housekeeping seal of approval.
He has read parts of my book when they were early on in their formation. I didn't ask him to sort of run through the entire text. There are certain places where I'm a little more critical of some of Ken's ideas while really, you know, holding most of them. And I didn't want to get the sort of celebrity effect that you might get in running your book through, you know, one of your intellectual mentors and having them sort of subtly influence you.
Yeah, yeah.
I wanted to maintain my more independent voice. But my book was reviewed by, you know, a fellow named Michael Washburn, who's a big writer in transpersonal, and then also Roger Walsh,
oh, yes,
who may be well known to your listening audience and who is very close friends with Ken, and they both really liked the book. So that was sort of one degree of separation for the piece.
Okay, and that certainly makes sense. Now, you say that integral psychotherapy is compatible with a number of other psychotherapies. Which
yes.
ones and how so?
Well, what I would say is that if you apply these five elements and understand how they show up in people and how they sort of show up in the room with clients, that there are a host of ways within the system to meet the needs of those sort of five major pieces. So it's quite possible to be a Jungian integral therapist or a psychoanalytic integral therapist, as long as you're willing to make a few adjustments and then probably augment what your main approach is with some other approaches which your main approach is not incredibly well suited to work with. So for example, if you were a Jungian therapist working with somebody with a phobia, you might be able to do quite a lot of work with them, but it might also be good to have a behavioral component which exposes the client, you know, to whatever the fearful stimulus is.
Okay, so it's also compatible with CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And what the model basically suggests is that as clients change in their maturity levels or their levels of identity development, that certain major questions and ways of perceiving the world become available to them. And that certain psychotherapies seem to have said, well, this is the optimal level of development. This is where we want to get you to. However, they're often very pathologizing of people or of systems that don't seem to reach quite their level, or often in the transpersonal sense, they're very critical or pathologizing of systems that seem to go beyond their level. So, for example, something like Albert Ellison, rational emotive therapy, is aiming for a very clear-headed, critical, you know, self-reflective view of the world, rational adult who questions reality. Albert Ellis is extremely critical of transpersonal psychology and doesn't really seem to understand it, just thinks that it's kind of all woo-woo and, you know, mystical obfuscation of what's really going on. So he in that system is aiming for a certain level of maturity in adulthood, but then they don't really have much to say of what happens after that. So that would be a simple example of where Integral would say, no, there are levels of adult development that follow just a more clear-headed, rational development. And we need systems to work with people as they proceed. So Wilbur would argue that something like Gestalt has a lot to say that isn't just about reason. It's about intuition and the body and the kind of integration of reason and, and intuition and heart. And that Jungianism would have even more to say as people sort of move into the stages where the numinous becomes, you know, very present for people in their waking lives. And so that's one of the ways that Integral suggests we integrate. And depending on the system that you consider your sort of home system, you again may be able to get a lot of work out of that and scale it up and down for clients with different levels of maturity. But there may be a point where you really need to move into a different system. So you might take up a Buddhism to help you understand the upper levels of development, or a contemplative Christianity or shamanistic practice, or et cetera, so that you're also integrating in your own life, and that will then allow you to support clients as they move up or, you know, in these levels of development, and also allow you to relate to what has become, what has come before in development. So what is early from childhood or adolescence, etc. So I'm really using here, this is the levels component or element to describe how the different psychotherapies might fit together.
Yeah, and it makes a lot of sense as I listen to you. You're talking about levels of development, and that was one of the things that struck me as I was reading your book, is that this is very much a developmental approach.
Yes.
And what you're really outlining here is that there are different stages of development across the lifespan, and so there may be issues and approaches that are particularly appropriate depending upon which level of development a person is at.
Yes.
Either chronologically or psychologically.
Yes. And one of the things I really love about Integral is that it opens a different level, I think, of a non-pathologizing. Because everything is seen as developmental, a lot of what we pathologize with people and sort of say that's not right is really actually just a developmentally normal step that they are going through that we might have passed through. But that for them is right on time. So, for example, you hear a lot of discussion about codependency. However, at a certain stage of our development, we actually don't have sort of this individuated adult independent self who knows what he or she wants and can identify very clear boundaries. As a natural step in our growth is to be more embedded in a group or an interpersonal context. And it's with those people that we often see what we label as codependent. But seen from a developmental perspective, it's actually just a natural expression of that particular stage, which we most often see in teenagers and young adults, but some people don't necessarily have the right support to move on, and therapy can be a support to help them get to a deeper, more functional level for, you know, adult society. But Integral really has this view that everything is developmental, and so much of what we judge or criticize negatively is really across levels, and that's when we take that away, there's a lot more room for meeting people just where they are. Mm-hmm. In their growth, and a lot of systems really emphasize that, humanistic and transpersonal. The difference is they don't always have the specificity on what it means to be where you are.
Yes.
And Integral really sources, you know, dozens, if not more, of traditions that have looked at things developmentally, sort of wrap them all in so that we can look very specifically at, okay, what's the outline of the stage that this client is generally working from? And knowing that more specifically gives a lot of containment for the therapy, and sort of suggests, okay, here's the next step for this client in their maturity, and here's a couple of things that probably are going to be at this moment over their head, meaning it's just not going to be relatable to them. So, you know, if you say to a teenager, you know, who's, you know, in their first love relationship, well, you know, you really just need to let your partner be who she is, and you can be who you are, you know, and then you'll come together and, you know, you'll share. That advice is very complex. That's very hard to do. Most therapists in our relationships struggle with that. That's a higher level of development.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't ask our clients to do that. We try to look for where they are and then support them right there. And we don't give those sort of unobtainable, or at least unobtainable in this part of their life, goals. We try to scaffold them to the next thing rather than to the ideal, which can happen. And that can be a big problem in transpersonal therapy too, in that, you know, sometimes transpersonal therapists will offer these very deeply spiritual insights as where their clients should be. Maybe not always taking into account that their clients are not really at that place in life yet, and they need other forms of therapy, and they need other lessons to help scaffold them eventually up to, you know, a place where they can take in transpersonal insights in the way that they probably were intended, rather than just grafting them over onto life issues, you know, and maybe in a certain way avoiding important life issues.
Yes. I like the way that you gave that example of the teenager. And so I want to encourage you to concretize our theoretical discussion with case examples whenever they come to mind. And I don't know if this is a fair question or not, speaking of other therapies. If I were a fly on the wall during an integral psychotherapy session, what would I see or hear that would be distinctive to this approach?
It's a great question. So some of what, because the model is very open, some of what you would see is distinctive to the therapist who's doing it.
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, there's not, at this point, and I don't think there ever really should be, sort of an easy formula for how you address all five elements in therapy, because we have just different sets of skills. And so some of us are more cognitively focused, some of us are more emotionally sort of attuned, some of us are very good with will or intuition as capacities, and so we're going to naturally gravitate to systems that use our strengths. And that's an important piece. What I would say is unique is that you will probably, if you listen closely, be hearing the integral therapist language things according to the stage the client is in. So that would be one element. Mm-hmm. You'll see the integral therapist differentiate what might be we would consider a state versus a stage. So that's another very important integral distinction. So if a client comes in having experienced a psychedelic sort of trip or used ayahuasca, et cetera, something like that, an integral therapist would tend to be, you know, very curious and want to investigate the state. But then the conversation becomes very much about how does that integrate into the person's stage as they are kind of living right now. So you'd hear a very strong differentiation, and as integralists who are very open to the transpersonal and to altered states, that distinction is a very grounding distinction because people can get confused by the sort of higher insights they have in states without really understanding how to pull that into the everyday, or perhaps understanding that that was really a glimpse of something that is in their future developmentally in terms of coming into, you know, a more everyday awareness. Then you might see, I think, in an integral psychotherapist, a willingness to approach problems from different perspectives. And this is more in what is called the quadrant model.
Take us through those four quadrants, if you will, and their relevance to psychotherapy.
And the quadrant model, the levels is probably the second most important part of integral theory. The quadrant model is probably the most important. It's the biggest framework.
Okay.
So basically, the quadrant model says that we have two ways of looking at the world. One is sort of from the subjective or inside perspective. So this is something that we know through our own awareness or through empathy with others. So it's an internal, interior way of looking at the world. And then we have the objective or sort of looking at the world from an outer way. And then what we do is add to that just a line between individual and collective. So I'll make sense of this. So this is, we would start with the upper left quadrant, which is the subjective individual. So these are things that only I know through my introspection and that you don't have direct access to unless we want to posit any kind of psi effect. But essentially, it's what I feel about myself. And so this is the realm of kind of a lot of psychotherapy in the sense of what am I feeling, what is my perception, what are my thoughts, etc. And then below that, we have the lower left, which is the subjective but about the collective. So this is really the relational view. So you and I in this very moment are having kind of a shared relational space around some values, interest in psychotherapy, interest in psychology and in the human. And there's something that it feels like to be in this we space together. And there's something that it feels like for a therapist to be in a we space with a client. So there are lots of views of psychology that focus on the we space, on the relationship, on the client's we space with their parents or significant others or with the culture. So that would be the lower left quadrant. So if we take just those two quadrants, we accept that some things that are important are really just inside the psychology of the individual, and we would ask questions and maybe suggest interventions. So if I were to say to somebody, I think you should really meditate and learn to be mindful of your breath and notice thoughts come and go, that might be an upper left individual subjective intervention. If we move to the lower left, I might say, okay, we need to work on some communication skills so that you can express to your partner how you're feeling about him and what your needs are in the relationship and what your concerns are. And so we're encouraging the client, or if I had a couple in my office, we'd be doing directly sort of a we space work. And it de-emphasizes to a certain extent the individual. So that's one half of the quadrant model. Does that make sense so far?
Yeah, it does. It does. It's actually reminding me of something from another quadrant of psychology, if you will. I think it was called the Harari window, and it comes from organizational psychology.
Sure. And there are lots of people who've come up with versions of these meta models, and so Wilbur is not always inventing new ideas as much as he is also synthesizing other people's ideas. Although the four quadrant model is kind of one of his nice new innovations. So then we would move to the upper right quadrant, which is the objective individual. So here it's sort of, you can imagine we're looking at a person from the outside, and we're studying their behavior through observation. So we're not having a conversation. We're just noticing what they're doing and what their behaviors are. And then we're also maybe looking at their biology, which is also objective. We're looking, you know, at cells under a microscope or brains in an MRI. And so this is the upper right objective individual. And from this perspective, we recommend or work with people around things like diet, exercise. This is the sort of medical quadrant, if you like. So this is where psychiatrists come in, or neuropsychologists, anybody who's doing sort of more of a study of the brain. Now, obviously, these quadrants overlap. So, you know, a neuropsychologist is looking and giving certain tests to sort of test brain functioning, but they're doing that by also talking to the person. So there's an overlap in these quadrants that's happening all the time.
Sure. I'm thinking of body work, for example, could be an overlapping one, right?
Absolutely. Body work is going to have psychological benefits. It may have relational benefits. But if we were to give it a home, we'd probably say body work starts with this more orientating to the physical organism of the person.
Okay.
And then we have the lower right quadrant, which is about objective collective, which is also like saying systems. So now we're seeing our person in systems of other people and in environments. So this is really like echo psychology, the psychology of the person in an environment. This is sociopolitics. This is socioeconomics. So we're trying to see the person and see the systems that they're in. So, for example, if I have a client who's entangled in a legal case or has major issues with a medical insurer or something like that, that element of their world is very relevant to the treatment. So when we take all four quadrants at once, and obviously it takes a little while to learn the quadrants and figure out, you know, how the mapping works, what we're doing is we're really hearing from these four perspectives at one time, and then we're open to really noticing, well, where does the change need to happen? So one of the biases that a psychotherapist like myself can get into, or a meditator can get into, is, oh, well, all the change is in the mind of the person. And I would say, yeah, sometimes that's really the case. The person needs to have a change in attitude. But sometimes if people are in a toxic work environment, where they have a boss who criticizes them or blames them, I was working with a client just last night who was really thrown off and very upset because a project didn't launch and she had warned her boss about what needed to happen and he didn't listen. And then when they got criticized, he pointed the finger at her. So he made her take the blame for something that wasn't her fault. And we were having a conversation about, you know, how many times would this have to happen before you might be done with that particular place of work? Because that's a very difficult position to be in. And I wouldn't just say to her, well, you know, you just need to adjust your attitude. And, you know, I might say to her at a certain point, you know, hey, maybe you need a switch in your system. So, or maybe if there's something else going on, I might say, oh boy, you know, you really need to change your diet or exercise or substances are becoming an issue. Or maybe I have some suspicion that there's something medical going on. So I'll send a client to, you know, a physician to get a checkup. So an integral therapist is really open and not constrained to saying there's one fix or there's one type of fix. What we need to do as integral therapists is to learn what's possible in these different quadrants, and some of that we can cover and some of that we're going to specialize in, but some of it we're just going to need to know, okay, who do I refer? Who are the people who are addressing this mm-hmm. quadrant in a specialization? So if you were watching an integral therapist, you would hopefully see a heightened level of flexibility to what is needing to happen with a client.
Okay. Now, one of the psychotherapeutic approaches that you discussed earlier was psychodynamic, could be Freudian, could be Jungian, which focus on things such as drives and the unconscious. Sure. What's the role of drives and the unconscious from an integral perspective?
So Wilbur, way back when, came up with a sort of a meta model of, instead of the unconscious, sort of the types of the unconscious. And he basically laid out five types. So he talked about what he called the ground unconscious, which is really the sum total of everything that a person might be unconscious. I don't particularly use that one. It's just a sort of holding category. Okay. The ones that are more useful, Wilbur was very, very influenced by Jung, particularly early on.
Yes.
So some of this will sound a little Jungian, but there's a collective unconscious. So there's the sort of forces that are in the collective that we are not conscious of that might be made more conscious. Then there's the submerged unconscious, and that's the unconscious of early childhood. So there's a certain kind of unconscious set of forces and dynamics we are unaware of. They start in childhood. They're patterned in childhood. And so integral really holds the importance of depth work in the sense of going back and investigating those early childhood relationships and experiences and making them conscious, because if they're not, then they're just operating unconsciously. There's the collective, there's the submerged, then there's what Wilbur calls the embedded unconscious. And that means the unconsciousness of your current stage of development. So there are some things that we don't see, not because of childhood, but because of the limiting view of our particular stage of development. So if we take, again, sort of that sort of typical rational modern adult, we would probably suggest that there's lots of irrational impulses and aspects of self, parts, subpersonalities, that person is not conscious of and that they have trouble locating. They might be helped to become better at that. And that there are also sort of transpersonal awarenesses that rational person is unconscious of. We'll get to that in a minute. But there's a lot of filtering that's happening from that rational stage of development. And that's a type of unconsciousness. So some of what we don't know is just bounded by our present capacity.
Okay.
Then we have what's called the emergent unconscious. And this is really the unconsciousness of our transpersonal, numinous, you know, spiritual potentials.
Yes.
So some of what causes us, you know, suffering is not to do with our childhood and not to do with our current stage. It's really mostly to do with potentials we haven't unfolded. So when I'm working with a client, I'm often asking the question, okay, where is the most constraint happening and where does the next learning step have to be? So for some people who don't have a good felt narrative of their childhood, they really need that piece to help flesh out and round out their awareness. And so I might work with them in what looks and feels like a course of psychodynamic therapy, in order to bring that on board. For other people, they may not have a tremendous amount of conflict from childhood, or they've metabolized that to a degree. And so I might work with them more on, okay, what is your present sort of here and now experience? And what are the parts of your life that feel like they have potential? And where do you want to grow? So more of a humanistic, now-centered approach.
Mm-hmm.
And then for other people who've really kind of actualized to a large degree and they're living a lot of their potentials, they have a sense of their childhood, so they're sort of more the complete package in that way, I might say, well, I think the limitations you're running up against is around some of these transpersonal awarenesses, and that, you know, us talking about those and maybe supporting you to investigate a practice, and a spiritual way of growing may be your growth edge. So in all those cases, we kind of hold the unconscious aspect and then try to encourage it to flower and unfold.
Okay. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Now, you also talk about lines, and I guess the lines actually refer to developmental stages. Do I have that right?
Yes. So the purpose of the concept of lines is just to say when we're first introduced to the concept of stages, it's usually easiest to just think about, well, there's sort of there are early childhood stages, and then there are stages of, you know, middle childhood, and then growing into conformity and moving on to reason or rationality. And we get a broad sense of what the steps are. Lines brings a little more complexity to that and sort of then suggests, you know, we don't move in stages in big chunks all at the exact same time.
Mm-hmm.
So if I am gaining access to some, you know, reason capacities and to a certain type of thinking, I'm probably stronger in one area than in another. Or even as I grow, I might be more cognitively strong than emotionally strong, or I might at a certain stage of development feel better about my spiritual life than about my sexual life or my creative life. So it's basically the lines, what it does is it divides it up into something like multiple intelligences, like Howard Gardner uses, and then sort of says, okay, we're uneven in our development. And it asks the question, where do we maybe want to focus our attention more specifically? So I might work with a client for some time just on their sexuality, because that's an area of their life that feels out of sync maybe with some of their deeper growth capacities. Or I might work with, you know, on relationships, or I might work on work life as a kind of line of development, how to put one out, put one's talents and skills out in the work world. So the lines just remind us that there are all different kinds of capacities in life and that, you know, we tend to be uneven and we have sort of a profile of different strengths and challenges.
Yeah, the picture I'm getting in my mind is instead of just one line that's kind of like a stacked bar chart, let's say, where you're just kind of, there's one line and you move from stage to the next stage to the next stage very neatly on a single continuum. I'm getting the picture of multiple lines coming out, and this would be more like a set of bar graphs where you know you're high here and you're low over there on the next line, and the next one you're even further along and so on.
That's totally accurate. And as a matter of fact, if it's so accurate that if you drew that, that would look a lot like how many of the drawings go in integral books. So yeah, you really got that terrific. And the other thing therapeutically about that is that for certain therapists, we might specialize in a line and say that, you know, this is really my home. This is where I'm most comfortable. So, you know, sexuality is a good example. Some therapists are sex therapists and they work in that. And the integral therapist would know, like, okay, this is my specialization. This is an important line to people. But there are other lines. And it may be that a client at a certain point needs another kind of work or help that will help them develop a different line. And so integral really encourages a kind of, I like the line sort of, it takes a village to raise a child.
Yeah.
I really see it as it takes a village, a network of healers to grow a person. And that no one therapy is going to be able to handle or therapist is going to be able to give a client everything they need. And that fits with our kind of global interconnected world. We have access to so many different kinds of wonderful work, that we can see from the integral perspective that we need to spread ourselves out and do different things at different times.
Yeah. So I'm going to skip towards the end of the book because
sure.
In the interest of time, you've got a chapter titled Gender and Typology in Integral
sure.
Psychotherapy. What can you tell us about the role of gender and typology?
So types is the fifth category. And types is basically the idea that just to simplify it, at any stage of development that we're in, that we have different stylistic leanings that are about our personality. So the Myers-Briggs would be an example. The Enneagram, if people are familiar with that, would be an example of looking at types. Then there would be things like culture. So we're culturally typed depending on what our home culture is. And then there are a lot of people work with masculine, feminine. So that would be something that's very deep in Jungian theory. What integral, you know, holds is just that, you know, types are hardest to prove as an empirical matter.
Uh-huh.
So there's lots of good, there's lots of great research on states of consciousness. I mean, we can put people in MRIs. There's a lot of very good research traditions behind the stages. So there are lots of assessments and they're very robust. Types tends to be harder to prove, but I think we all have an intuition and a sense that we differ. And so integral basically holds that, you know, there are masculine in quotes, feminine in quotes, styles or types. And that we're exploring these issues in the sense that I think the culture is having a moment where we're really pondering how much these things have an effect. And I think Integral's contribution to that is to sort of hold the both and space,
mm-hmm.
which is to say, we're really, you know, there's so much that men and women have in common, and that yet there do seem to be some broad average differences that, while small, have an impact on people's lives and influence their choices to the best that we can, you know, describe, and may influence aspects of their psychology. So there are some folks in the integral community who really do a lot of what I would consider masculine, feminine work and working with those polarities, either with couples or working with people to develop deeper masculine or feminine capacities. And then I think there's an element of the integral community, and I'm more in this element, that's just looking a little more skeptically at that and pragmatically saying, you know, that stuff is useful, but it also can kind of label people unnecessarily,
mm-hmm.
box them in.
Mm-hmm.
So this is where kind of something like the integral mantra of true but partial, you know, so to say men and women are different is true but partial. To say men and women are all just humans, true but partial. And we have to hold, as Jung might like to say, the tension of those opposing views.
Yeah.
And we have to sort of await for the reconciling third to emerge out of some of those tensions.
Uh-huh. You've also got a discussion of diversity, and I don't know that that's built into very many approaches. What does integral psychotherapy have to say about diversity and working with diversity? I guess that's that fourth quadrant, actually.
Yes.
Yeah.
So this is one of the things that makes integral great, is it sort of fully has a place for the multicultural view of psychotherapy and psychology. The home would be in the lower left quadrant, as we're talking about culture. And then if we're talking about socioeconomics and class, that home would be in the lower right. So those features are sort of just natural and innate to the integral model. What integral would add, though, is that really there's diversities in all four quadrants. So there's a diversity in terms of how people think and feel, and that might be a diversity according to their stage of maturity. There's a diversity in people's family relationships in the lower left quadrant, and there's a diversity in their cultures. And then there's a diversity in their socioeconomic and environmental circumstances. Growing up in a city is very different than growing up maybe on an island, you know, where you have lots of access to nature. And then there's what we might call, there's diversity in biology. Some people struggle with chronic pain, for example. That's a very diverse situation in that a person has to adjust their life in a new way. And there's also something that we might call neurodiversity. And this is, there's a fellow named Nick Walker who identifies as being on the autism spectrum.
Yes, who I've interviewed, by the way, and met.
Oh, okay. Oh, yeah. Terrific. Yeah. So,
and also into martial arts. You're into martial arts. Do you have a martial arts connection with him?
No, we came together. There is a manuscript on the topic of integral diversity, which I am co-editing, and Nick is one of our authors, and we're in talks to have it published. So that was how we came together.
Oh yeah, he's a very high degree black belt in Aikido.
Yes, and brilliant, just a brilliant fellow.
Mm-hmm.
And so he, you know, talks about neurodiversity, that our brains aren't exactly the same.
Yeah.
So integral is really open to diversities in all of those ways. And when my clients come in, I'm looking to track that. So I want to know things about their culture and where they grew up. I want to know things about their family, if they have those, you know, sort of kind of health conditions or whatever. I want to get that very unique picture. So the idea of integral is not to just, is not to homogenize people, but it's to have this broad framework so that we can actually see more of their individuality and hold more of that. So I think integral has a lot to say about diversity, and also has some critiques of the multicultural viewpoint. And this is a big part of integral for people who get into it, which is that, you know, the postmodern viewpoint is really quite ascendant, and it has to do, you know, with kind of that our worldview is entirely bound by our culture and the language we use, et cetera, et cetera. And that it, you know, it's, the gaps are very difficult to bridge. And integral would kind of hold a both and there, that there's something very unique and shaping about home culture, but we have to hold the particular with the universal. So both are true but partial. And that a lot of the approaches to diversity that have come out now are just really more focused on the specific. And it's kind of can, on in the negative sense, can lead into kind of identity politics, or in on the other end to sort of denial. Some other folks just deny that any of that is important. Integral is sort of holding a space between those two and sort of offering a philosophical critique of some of the ways diversity is done. And I would say that that's my experience in practice. I've seen clients, because I work in the Bay Area, probably from over 20 different countries, and probably most of the ethnicities that are in the Bay, and the Bay is incredibly diverse.
Yeah.
And absolutely, culture has a shaping effect, but you know, there are some real deep human universals, you know, around love and family and work in the world and children, that, you know, guide most of who people are. So I've really seen in my office and in my practice the last 15 years how the tension and the relationship, which I think is enriching, between the specific and the universal. And so some of the postmodern diversity models are a little too they're a little too one-sided for what I think is effective practice. We need to move more to a middle space, a dialectical space.
You know, some proportion of my audience are in training to be psychotherapists, aspiring to be psychotherapists. How does one become an integral psychotherapist, and where do you see this going in the future? Do you see integral, you know, growing in the future? So as we wind down, kind of speak about those.
Sure, absolutely. So in terms of where I see it going in the future, and then maybe I'll talk about sort of newly practicing psychotherapists, I think we're, and everybody is talking about how we're headed into a global society. And what that means at the level of practice systems and meaning systems, how we view people, how we work on growth, what's valuable, is that we are constantly running up into other meaning systems that conflict with our own. I've heard the term that we are sort of constantly fragilized, meaning that it's so hard to just stay in one bubble with your worldview without bumping into so many other worldviews, even in just for probably your new students in your graduate classes. They probably are confronting people with so many different interests in psychology. And, you know, when they get around to clients, clients are also going to, you know, present them from being from all different places in the world and different religious systems, et cetera, et cetera. So what we really need at this day and age is we need these larger meta models, of which Wilbur is just one, but happens to be handy and very elegant, to allow us to navigate these competing meaning systems and all these different systems of psychotherapy without having to push away or without having to reject. You know, Jung once said this right around the time of World War I. He said, you have to let the other guy's argument count for something. That's like the foundation of a civil society, mm-hmm. is allowing the other person's statements and perspective to mean something and to carry truth. So I think that integral is probably one of, you know, a set of emerging approaches to psychotherapy and to integrating spiritual work that is coming. So this is actually the future. And at a certain point, we're going to look back and we're going to see that people who are just only in their home model, that they are kind of limiting themselves and are not adapting to the flexible universe that we find ourselves in. So I really see integral psychotherapy as part of a new wave. And that's not to throw out what's come before, because what's come before is so useful and all these systems are great. It's more to situate them in an overall sort of map that allows them to thrive without having to do all of the work. So you can still have a strong Freudian influence if you like Freud. And there are things that I love about Freud without having Freudianism have to cover all of these other dimensions, which at which point, you know, it just strains what it's capable of. So I really see this as the future, and, you know, myself and the other integral psychotherapists thinks where this is where one of the directions the field is going to be going. Should I pause there? Or should I answer the question of new psychotherapists?
Yeah, briefly. That was such an elegant statement that I was tempted to just wrap it up there. But go ahead.
I would say for new psychotherapists, I would just say start where you can read about the integral model. There are lots of very shorter, accessible books. My book is intended directly for psychotherapists. But basically, you just start with whatever you're being trained in now. So start with CBT. That's a very potent system. Start with a psychodynamic approach. Start with a humanistic approach. But then see if you can, in your training, move around a little bit to some different age groups. Get experience with children and adolescents. Take supervisors with very different views so that you start to get some of these pieces that are really out there, and that, you know, psychotherapy is a wonderful profession. You don't really have to retire. So we have long periods of time to kind of get to these more integrative sensibilities. And so what I encourage people is to sort of take this attitude of lifelong learning. And if you're then having the integral model sort of in the background, that's going to help just give some shape to that learning so it doesn't feel chaotic. It just means, oh, okay, these are the parts that I'm learning now, and I can add these to what I have already learned and what I might learn in the future.
Well, that sounds like just wonderful advice, and you're an excellent spokesperson for this integral approach. So, Dr. Mark Forman, I want to thank you for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Well, thank you, David. It was a total pleasure to be with you, and I really appreciate you and the questions that you ask. I think they're great.
I must say, I'm impressed by what an articulate spokesman Dr. Mark Forman is for the integral perspective generally and integral psychotherapy in particular. You know, all these years I've thought that Shrink Wrap Radio was flying more or less under the banner of humanistic psychology. After this conversation with Mark, however, it occurs to me that referring to it as the Integral Psychology Podcast would actually be quite a good fit, inasmuch as I interview people from such a wide spectrum and am always looking for the grain of truth or larger in each. I ran this by Mark, and as a recent convert to the podcast, he agreed. Well, I'm not likely to start making a formal identification with integral psychotherapy this late in the game, but I must say I'm very impressed by Mark's presentation of it, and if I were just starting out, I might easily identify with it. Back when I was doing psychotherapy, I described my approach as eclectic, and I know many other psychotherapists describe themselves that way as well. It seems to me that integral psychotherapy might offer a better container with a bit more rationale and structure for therapists who are disposed toward an eclectic blend. So once again, the title of Dr. Mark Forman's book is A Guide to Integral Psychotherapy, Complexity, Integration, and Spirituality in Practice. If you'd like to order it and at the same time help to support Shrink Wrap Radio, please go to our site and click on the Amazon.com banner ad that you'll see in the right-hand sidebar.
Dr. Dave has given me many hours of interesting listening with his amazing podcasts. This week, I finally clicked on the support button on his website and sent a gift. Maybe you would like to send Dr. Dave a gift in this season of giving to show your appreciation for all his work. It feels good to give back to someone who gives so much. Think about it. It's worth doing.
Thank you, Kerry Schwartz. I can't put it any better than that. I hope you'll join Kerry if you haven't already. Some recent donors whose names have been added to our honor roll are Beverly Scheer, Robin Smith, Barbara Favre, and Rhonda Horn. Thank you all. A couple of weeks ago, you heard me interview Dr. Stephen Buser about his new book on DSM-5 Insanely Simplified. I remarked at the time that I hoped listeners wouldn't skip it, thinking it would not be of interest to them. In fact, I've heard from several who said that they almost skipped it, but were glad that they didn't, because of the Jungian alternative to diagnostic labels that Dr. Buser presented. Dr. Buser also directs the Asheville Jung Center, which hosts webinars with leading Jungian analysts. We have a strategic relationship with them, such that you can save money by using our link to register. A six-week series on the shadow and the problem of evil begins on October 1st, and the first one will feature Dr. Murray Stein. I encourage you to register. I plan to. You can sign up at a discounted rate by going to www.ashevillejungcenter.org/wrap or by clicking on the link for the Asheville Jung Center in the left-hand sidebar on our site. Do you have a website? If so, you might have experienced what I did a couple of years ago, which was an outside attack on my site. The company that saved my bacon is called Sucuri. That's spelled S-U-C-U-R-I. And you can find them at sucuri.net. They are the industry leader in security options for websites and blogs. I use them, and you should too. And as an affiliate, we will get a small portion of whatever you spend with them. Just go to our Sucuri banner ad in the left-hand sidebar on our site. Let me call your attention again to one of our sponsors in the right-hand sidebar. You'll see an ad for Unflame, an herbal pain remedy designed by Dr. Robert Hedaya, who I interviewed recently on Shrink Wrap Radio number 460. Well, I can tell you, I use that herbal remedy, and I think you may find it useful if you have any aches or pains. You can save $5 on every bottle of Unflame herbal ordered through Amazon for Shrink Wrap Radio listeners only. Use the checkout code UNFL1815, and you'll find a link to that in the right-hand sidebar. Finally, for any of you who are not already members of Audible.com, my favorite audiobook service, here's a recommendation to go with today's interview with Dr. Mark Forman. Audible.com actually has six audiobook offerings of books by Ken Wilber. The most recent one is titled Cosmic Consciousness, and it's narrated by Ken Wilber as well. You'll get 12 hours of education and inspiration. If you're not already an Audible.com subscriber, you can get this audiobook for free and to keep with no obligation to continue your subscription by going to audibletrial.com/shrink. And of course, there are also 180,000 other titles for you to choose from.
Hi, this is Dwayne Law, licensed acupuncturist and author of the book Before Meds, After Meds, Complementary and Alternative Medicine for Anxiety and Depression. And you're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Thank you, Dwayne Law, who was my guest on episode number 350 on the role of nutrition in mental health. I think I'll skip the reading of mail from our listener community today, inasmuch as we've run long. So as usual, you can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can also leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. You can leave voicemail using our app or our message phone at 415-830-4014. Thanks to today's guest, Dr. Mark Forman, for bringing us up to speed on integral psychotherapy. My next interview will be with Kim Hermanson, Ph.D., coach, author, intuitive, and adjunct faculty at Pacifica Graduate Institute, and we'll be speaking about the power of metaphor. So until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.